Okay, good evening, everybody. Thank you for joining me. This is Kabbalah, You and the Cosmic Christ, Part 5. And tonight we're going to be focusing on Jesus's I Am statements in the Gospel of John, because these are very much misunderstood and interpreted at the tribal level, which helps absolutely nobody, especially if you're aspiring to be a mystic. But I would like to start by referring back to the episode a couple of weeks ago about betrayal and forgiveness, the crucifixion, because one of you sent me a heartfelt message about it. And it is quite shocking to realise that betrayal and forgiveness are part of the heart of the Christian journey, or the human spiritual journey. It's not actually Christian at all. It's the teachings of Jesus Christ, but they should be universal rather than just tied up in one religion. And very important question, which is whether forgiveness comes before some kind of restoration of the harm caused, some sort of reparation, or whether it precedes it, and whether it precedes whether or not reparations are offered. If somebody doesn't apologise to you and does not regret what they did to you, can you forgive? You must. You simply must. Not because of the other person, ever, but to set you free. That's the secret of forgiveness. It's never about the other person. And to forgive does not mean to condone, and it does not mean to let them get away with it. Byron Katie is brilliant on this. If you've ever followed her work on the internet or in her books, it's just called The Work. And her name is Katie, but she calls herself Byron Katie. That may be her surname. But she does extraordinary work on the turnaround of the blame that we put out and this need that we have that the other must apologise first. Because as soon as we say the other must apologise first, we have tied ourselves into the continual wound. And of course, it's totally logical. The ego absolutely says there must be reparation. The other person must say they're sorry. There has to be apology. And we have this culture nowadays that everybody has to apologise for things that their parents did even, or which were done many, many years ago. And I'm all for apologies. The more we can apologise, the better, and the more we can own our shortcomings, absolutely. But if we rely on the other person to do it, we are trapped. And the difficulty is, of course, it's very hard to forgive unless the other person has come and made some kind of reparation to us, if we're willing to accept that reparation. Of course, sometimes people won't even accept the offer of the reparation. But I do find that the Hawaiian technique of Ho'oponopono is very useful here. Whenever there's a situation I haven't forgiven or I find very hard to forgive, I do this mantra, which is, I love you, I'm sorry, please forgive me, thank you, repeatedly, again and again. Now, you don't have to mean it. That's what's so useful about it, because you won't mean it to start with if somebody's done you wrong. But what it does is it doesn't talk to the other person, it doesn't talk to God, it talks to your inner child. And the ego is basically our inner child that is screaming and ranting and blaming and being terribly happy, terribly unhappy, terribly sad, terribly blaming, terribly depressed, terribly bright, all full of sort of repetitive actions, sort of bipolar in a way. The ego is naturally slightly bipolar. And it calms the inner child because it says to it all the things that we need the other to say. The other is probably never going to say, I love you, I'm sorry, please forgive me, thank you. But they're more likely to if you've actually created the vessel into which to receive it. Father Richard Rohr of the Centre of Action and Contemplation teaches that. He talks about the first half of life, the building of the vessel of the ego. And it's from that, on that, that we stand to elaborate, to strengthen, to grow our soul and to use our consciousness. And of course, if the vessel is shattered when we're young by betrayal, it's very, very hard to stand on that vessel because it's so, so rocky. And the Ho'oponopono technique heals the vessel. It doesn't heal it 100%. It heals it the way the Japanese do when they mend their vases, their broken vases, with streams of gold. You can still see where the wound has been, but it's been replaced by gold. And that's what happens when you forgive the cause of your wound and use the scar of the wound to be a healer, to help others. That's what the true meaning of the wounded healer is. It's not the person who's still suffering. As Deepak Chopra famously said, I'm not asking you to give up your pain, but I am asking you to give up your suffering. Suffering is when we've made whatever happens to us wrong. Suffering, what happens is when we make death wrong. When we lose a partner and we say it's wrong. Because death happens to everybody, so really it can't be wrong. Yes, circumstances can be unfortunate and they can be tragic, but as soon as we focus on that being wrong, we cause suffering to ourselves. And we are of no help to the rest of the world when we suffer. So tonight we're definitely focusing on Jesus's phrase, I am. And we need to start by looking at what the I am phrases are. They're all in the Gospel of John. And John is the mystical gospel. It's the one that is meant to be the transpersonal gospel. It's not about Jesus as a human. It's about Jesus as the representation of Christ, the representation of divine consciousness on the earth. There are 9 of these sayings. People tend to say there are 7 because one of them is in a slightly different format from the others and one of them is repeated, which is perfect for Kabbalists because it means it's Keter to Malkut, Malkut to Keter, which is the turning of the tree from God being in absolutely everything, God the transcendent and God the immanent. And they're all distinguishable from any other time that Jesus says, I am, because usually he says, Eimi, which means I am. But for these sayings, he says, ego Eimi. There's an emphasis. Now, ego, of course, can mean ego, but it's just a different form of Greek for I am. And I asked my tutor in New Testament Greek when I studied at Birmingham University whether it was feasible that Jesus was referring back to the name of God, I am that I am, and representing God the immanent, God the transcendent. And he, who's a great scholar, Professor David Parker, has written a wonderful book about the living testament of the Gospels. I can't remember the exact title of it, but it's an extraordinary book and it's very, very helpful. But he said he was virtually certain that Jesus was doing that. So it's not just me, there's a scholar doing it as well. So the ultimate name of God, we're looking at slide number 3 now, was the name revealed to Moses at the burning bush. And we talked about this already in the course, but it's worth going back to it. Because the vision of Moses at the burning bush, a kind of tree of life, because it was a bush that was not consumed, is an experience of the whole tree of life in action in Moses. And it's also a perfect description of how we use the chakras. Now, if you look at slide number 4, you'll see that my painting of the tree of life has got the chakras already laid out in it, the colouring of the chakras, which is what my teacher Warren Kenton, Seb Ben Shimon Halevi is his author's name, taught us. And it's really important to know that all these traditions work together. So if we look at Moses and the burning bush, we can actually see how this works with the chakras. The crown chakra is Keter. The third eye chakra is the link between Binah and Chokhmah. The throat chakra is Da'at, which is the window between worlds. And the heart chakra is the soul triad, Gevura Hesed to Tiferet. The solar plexus chakra is the awakening triad of Hod, Tiferet to Netzach. The gonadic or sacral chakra is the link between Hod, Netzach and Yesod, what's known as the willingness triad. And the root chakra is Malkut. And they do fit extremely well, but we will look a little more closer than that. Right. Slide number 5. So the story fits onto Jacob's ladder very beautifully. Actually, no, I'm going to go back to 4. And I'm going to actually outline exactly how this works now rather than doing it later. So how it works, and you can read this yourself in the book of Exodus, is that the throat chakra is the angel that speaks to Moses out of the bush. The first thing Moses hears is the voice of the angel, and that is the communication of clairaudience, which comes through the throat chakra. And he perceives it, the bush itself, the divine fire in the bush, he's going to perceive that through his third eye, which is Da'at. So we don't know whether it was a physical burning bush or whether Moses perceived it, but of course mystical sight is extremely powerful. And God is speaking through the angel, God the crown chakra is speaking through the angel at the throat chakra, and Moses is perceiving this at the third eye. And then God asks Moses to identify his real self and to have compassion upon his people. So that's calling into action Moses' heart chakra. Because the true self is the soul, which is Tiferet Gevura Hesed. And Gevura and Hesed are judgment or discernment and loving kindness, respectively. So when we are coming from the level of the heart, the true soul, we are able to discern and be kind. So God is calling Moses to that level so that he can have discernment about what needs to be done for the people in Egypt and have compassion upon his people. Pharaoh represents Tiferet, which is the solar plexus chakra or the awakening triad. And Pharaoh in this respect is the negative power. Moses' true self is also the positive aspect of Tiferet, but Pharaoh is the negative aspect who is holding everything below it prisoner. And below Tiferet are the drives and the talents and the ego and the physical self. So everything below Tiferet is in thrall to Tiferet, if Tiferet is operational. In many people, it really isn't operational, except in very brand new circumstances when you have to deal with something that you don't know or understand and the ego can't deal with. But the negative aspect of Tiferet is pride. And Pharaoh is certainly full of pride. And Tiferet, when it's negative, believes that it owns the world. It's negative politics, if you like, negative monarchy, negative power in any way, shape or form. The Egyptians are the gonadic chakra. They're the ones who are carrying out Pharaoh's wish. And when there is power that is negative in Tiferet, ruled by the desire for power or negative ambition, then it will control everything beneath it. And you see this with big pharma and corporations and governments. So the people who are carrying out Pharaoh's demands is the ego, the people of Egypt. And right at the bottom are the slaves, the Israelite slaves, who are fighting for survival. And the Malkut, the base chakra, is all about physical survival in the physical world. So the burning bush also fits onto Jacob's ladder. This is slide number 5. Because the burning bush is Atzilut, the top world on the tree of life, the white world on Jacob's ladder. The burning bush is Atzilut, the divine world from which emanates everything else. And the presence of the angel is the non-sephira of Da'at in the world of Atzilut coming through to the spiritual world and again in the world of Yetzirah coming through from spirit to the physical world. And in us, Da'at represents the messages that our body sends to us and we say to our body. This is really is a cat flap of two concepts, two different worlds working with each other. Moses is positioned in the soul triad, Gevura, Hesed and Tiferet, which on the ladder is placed, it's 5 circles up in the centre of Jacob's ladder. And that's the place which links heaven and earth, which we talked about last week, which is the kingdom of heaven. So Moses has come to himself, he's come to his senses, he's in his true self, and from there he can rise into the soul to his compassion and discernment. And Pharaoh, again, is the false pride of Tiferet with the Egyptians below him. So below Pharaoh is the lower psychological world and the physical world that he rules over, which is in thrall, enslaved to him. And just a quick aside, going to slide number 6, it's called Jacob's ladder because of the story in Genesis, when Jacob dreamed a dream. He saw a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven, and behold, the angels of God ascended and descended on it. And that's why we call the 4 trees together Jacob's ladder. And the full text in Genesis says that Jacob lighted upon a certain place and tarried there all night because the sun was set. And he took of the stones of that place and put them for his pillows and lay down to sleep. And he dreamed, and behold, a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God ascended and descended on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it, because God itself is beyond the divine world. God is all-embracing beingness in all things. So God is beyond it. In fact, when an atheist says to me, God doesn't exist, I totally agree with them, because God is beyond existence. Existence is on the ladder, God is beyond and around and just pure beingness itself. Anyway, the Lord stands above this ladder, looking down at Jacob, and says, I am the Lord God of Abraham, your father. The Lord God is Yahweh Elohim, remember, which is the masculine and the feminine working together. And he says, the land where you lie is to thee, I will give it and to your seed. And skipping a paragraph, he says, behold, I am with you, and I will keep you in all places where you go, and will bring you again to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done that which I have spoken to thee of. And Jacob wakes from his sleep and says, surely the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not. And of course, Jacob is also famous for wrestling with the angel. Jacob's wrestling with the angel is what changes his name from Jacob to Israel. In Hebrew, Israel means one who struggles with God. And we are all ones who struggle with God. The house of Israel are the adults who admit the struggle with God. The children of Israel are the people clustered around the ego who are still not awakened yet to have the struggle, because it's always a struggle with the angel. It's always a struggle about religion and faith, because the ego calls to us so much and we just don't want to rise up. We don't want to be responsible. We don't want to be conscious, because it's very, very tiring. And Jacob calls the place where he saw the ladder in his dream Bethel, which is the house of God. And interestingly, the name of the city near there is called Luz, which is light. So, slide number 7. Let's go back to the burning bush. Moses said to God, behold, when I come to the children of Israel, and shall say unto them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they say to me, what is his name? What shall I say unto them? And God said to Moses, I am that I am. Thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel. Again, the children, not the house of Israel, not the mystics, but the ones who are still suffering, the ones who are lower down on the tree, unconscious. I am has sent me unto you. So in the Hebraic Kabbalistic system, Moses would be a Messiah, because God has authorized him as the anointed of his time to set his free people free. And this is what the Jews were expecting of any Messiah, to set people free physically, by freeing the slaves, because Moses set a dangerous precedent, if you like. But that's all relevant for the Bible, because you have to start off by freeing people physically. And Esther, who's another of the known Hebrew messianic figures, also frees her people physically. But once we come to the story of Jesus, it's about freeing us psychologically and spiritually, so we can free ourselves, so we aren't bound to the powers that seem to oppress us. And if you're on social media anyway, you'll see so many people with all the complaining and projecting and anger, which is the children of Israel, which is you. It's your fault. I blame you. It's your fault. You did this to me. Whereas the mystic knows, no. The situation I'm in is the situation that I'm in, and I am responsible for that situation. And you can step right out of the karma of your country and your family. So really, when Jesus came, it is, I am, has sent him as a representation of the anointed. And when Jesus says, ego eimi, he's referring back to his father. I am, I am. I am the transcendent, the I am God, Christ in Jesus of Nazareth. So God is in Jesus as him, and the only difference between him and us is that he knows it, and he lived it. So the great I am sayings of Jesus are not about Jesus the person. They're to indicate the link between the internal and the external divinity. Both are one in a human being, and the human being is Christed. And it can happen for nanoseconds, or it can happen for years. I might have managed a nanosecond myself, and you might have managed a nanosecond yourself. But generally, we have to be of a slightly higher level than we are at the moment to get there. Now, John is the gospel of the highest of the four worlds on Jacob's ladder, the gospel of the divine. So we must read it transpersonally, which means that Jesus, the persona, the person, is kind of irrelevant in John. We're meant to read it with us in the place of Jesus. John is meant to be a meditation drawing us to our higher self. So the whole of the gospel is a meditation. There are no parables in John. Jesus never says, this is like. He just says, this is. And for the children of Israel, you've got to give metaphor, you've got to give simile, you've got to say it's like that, it's like that, it's like that, because that's what Yes of the Ego understands. It must compare. It's like this or it's like that. What was the wedding dress like? Oh, it was a bit like Joanna's wedding dress, but with sleeves. That's the best way of describing something to somebody, because if you've seen Joanna's wedding dress, you'll immediately have the image in your life, in your mind, and the like helps you to make a similar picture. But if we're working at the level of Atzilut, it's all new. It's all fresh. There are no comparisons. And that's pretty tiring. It's inspirational, but it's tiring. And the amazing thing about these sayings is they fit beautifully onto the diagram of the Tree of Life. Am I shoving them in with a shoehorn? I don't think I am. And you're very welcome to say I am, but I really don't think so. I'm just amazed that nobody else seems to have done this work. It seems to me that they fit beautifully, and I can only teach you what I'm learning. So let's see if we agree on it together. But let's go through these sayings. Chronologically in the Gospel of John, they are as follows. Number one, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall not hunger, and he that believes on me shall never thirst. And then Jesus repeats that and just says again, I am the bread of life. Now, for me, that is bread, physical bread, and not physical bread, because Jesus says man cannot live by bread alone. And also bread is what we tend to term manna, which is what was given to the Israelites when they left Egypt and went out into the wilderness. And of course, for us, that's what the spiritual journey is all about. We have to leave Egypt. Egypt is our tribe. Egypt is our job. It's our family. Egypt is the mortgage. Egypt is the school catchment area. Egypt is the folk we meet down the pub. If we want to develop into mysticism, we have to leave that and live on the edge of it. We have to go out to the desert. And if we go out to the desert, we're cutting ourselves off from all the safe supplies. And of course, the Egyptians followed the Israelites, but they didn't manage to pull them back. And quite frequently, the Israelites moaned and whinged and wanted to go back because it was much more comfortable back in Egypt. And out in the wilderness, the Israelites were fed by manna. Manna in Hebrew means, what is it? I love that. They're going, what is it? This stuff, food that is falling from heaven. But we also translate it as bread. So I would speculate, and I think there's good grounds for speculation, that I am the bread of life. The fact that Jesus mentions it twice in the same chapter is referring to bread the transcendent and bread the immanent, if you like. I'm the bread of life. He who comes to me shall not hunger. It works on both levels, because Jesus actually does provide people with physical food. We look at the miracle of the loaves and the fishes, and also he provides us with spiritual food. So when we are connected to our own Christ self, which is the higher self, the crown chakra, we are direct channels, straight to God and from God. And at that point, we can manifest everything we need. And I mean that literally. We can manifest furniture, money, love, pretty much everything that's physically possible and a few things that possibly aren't, when we're at that level. Now, I've taught prosperity consciousness off and on for 25 years now. I don't do it much nowadays because I don't need it, thank God, but I'm always coming back to it because it comes back again and again for clients. This idea that you may not be spiritual and rich is in direct contravention to Jesus' teachings and his life. We are taught by Christianity erroneously that Jesus was poor. There's no evidence for that whatsoever in the Gospels. It's perfectly fair to say he may have been despised and rejected, but that doesn't mean to say financially poor or poor in what he may have owned. I don't know what he owned when he wasn't travelling. I don't know where he lived. We know he stayed with Peter in Capernaum. We speculate from knowing how holy men generally worked in those days that they would travel in the summertime and work at their homes in the wintertime, Jesus and the disciples, but we don't know that's true. But we do know, or at least we think we know, that Jesus and his parents were given gold, frankincense and myrrh when he was born, which are very wealthy things. I don't think they used them all up in Egypt when they travelled down in there. That's also an interesting reference, that the Holy Family had to go down into Egypt in the Gospel of Matthew, which is the one about the physical world and the genealogy, the sort of masculine tribal genealogy that we're used to. The Holy Family has to go down into Egypt and then come back out again. It's a kind of parallel to the Exodus story. But apart from that, Jesus' teachings about prosperity are actually about not being possessed by the physical world. He does say you cannot worship God and mammon, and that's absolutely true. But mammon is a Hebrew word which means money as opposed to God. It's actually specific that it is money detached from divinity. Money associated with God is different. Money for good works. Money is absolutely neutral. Money is just a concept invented by human beings, which was originally invented to try and make things fair. I've got sheep, you've got chickens. We swap. You can have 2 sheep a year in return for the eggs. Then one year my sheep die, but I still need the eggs. So I say to you, I am going to give you a token that means I will give you extra sheep next year if you will please continue to give me the eggs so I and my family may live. And quite possibly we might make a deal with the holy man of the village, or at least have it witnessed that we've got an arrangement that I will give you more in future in return for my continuing survival now. Now, if I die, maybe that will be honoured by my child, or maybe it won't. So a token is very, very useful to keep that agreement. It's an agreement between human beings to be fair. That's what money is. Not necessarily how we use it, but that's what it was created to be, and money is entirely neutral. When Jesus does his teaching to the rich man who says, "What must I do to enter the kingdom of heaven?" Jesus just says, "Follow the commandments." And then the young man does exactly what all of us do. "No, no, 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 I want to do something more. I want to do something more special. I want to be more important. I want to be more important in the kingdom of heaven. I want to learn faster. I want to do more." A bit like the Reiki student who wants to be Reiki master within 3 weeks of being Reiki one. And yes, I was that student, but I didn't manage to have a teacher who would be that stupid as to teach me that soon. So Jesus then says to him, "Okay, you really, really want this, do you? You want to work at my level? Fine. Give up everything you have, sell it, give to the poor, and follow me. And live as I do." Now, he's not saying live a poor life, because Jesus is travelling around being fed by the people in the villages. In those days, people actually left food outside a village to tempt a visiting holy man in, because they didn't have TV, they didn't have books, they didn't have radio, they didn't have the movies, they didn't have concerts. All they had round the fire at night was stories. So people with new stories were incredibly valuable. It would be the equivalent of, let me see, who, Katy Perry or Lady Gaga or Madonna at Wembley or at Madison Square Gardens. It would be a huge, huge pull when there's a holy man. Everybody's going to run there. They're going to feed the holy man. They're going to try and get them into the village. Apart from anything else, you can squabble with the holy man. You can have a wonderful evening disagreeing with him all night. So the fact that Jesus wasn't wealthy with possessions, didn't live in a mansion, doesn't mean to say he wasn't incredibly wealthy. He got everything he needed. It also says in the book of Luke that Mary Magdalene, Joanna and Susanna ministered unto him of their substance. And the word substance is financial substance. So we have 3 women there who are actually looking after Jesus' financial needs. They must have been, one of them was married to Herod's steward Chuser. The other 2 must have been divorcees or widowed, otherwise they wouldn't have had the money under their control. However, they definitely ministered unto Jesus. He was sponsored. He was looked after. He was not poor. And that's how the mystic aims to live lightly on the earth without too many possessions, and to just call into being what we need when we need it. Last weekend, I hadn't got anything for supper. We'd had a difficult week. The week before I'd been away, and as you probably all know by now, our dog died, so there was a bit of distraction there, and I was very busy during the week, and I hadn't got anything for supper for the weekend. And I literally said, God, can you help? Of course I can go shopping, but God, can you help? Next morning, the local gamekeeper turns up with a brace of pheasant. Now, I can skin a pheasant. That's not a problem. Perfect dinner. And we're still eating it. It's now Wednesday, and we've still got pheasant casserole, which will do us another couple of days. So thank you, God. I just asked, and it came. I'm very good at asking for certain things and very bad at asking for other things. So who we are and what our astrological profile is like will usually dictate where it's easier for us to live lightly and where it's not so easy. But if you're working at the level of the crown chakra, you can just manifest stuff. And you can heal. Right, second one. Second Jesus saying, I am saying, I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in the darkness, but shall have the light of life. Now, in the Bible, it's me with a capital M. So that is Emu, the Greek, but the fact that it's me with a capital M is also making this emphatic point. We are not talking about Jesus, the persona. We're talking about Jesus who is representing Christ. Remember, Christ is not Jesus' surname. So when we're connected, we're illuminated. We're inspirational. We are inspired. And we don't lose ourselves in fear. And when we understand that, that's when we can manifest. That's when we can be the light for other people. There was an interesting conversation today about grief and a very interesting article I read on the internet about how often we get it so wrong when somebody's grieving. We tell them our own story of grief because somehow we seem to think that that's comforting for them, but very often it isn't. The person doesn't want to hear how you're grieving, they just want to be acknowledged in their own grief. And when we're illuminated, when we're higher up, when we're working in our souls, we don't need to tell our story at all. Our story is basically irrelevant because we're God's story. So when we're helping somebody grieve, the answer is really just to listen, to be the enlightened listener, not to be the one who needs to tell our story. Because when you speak, you don't learn anything. Sometimes, actually, some stuff comes through when I talk, and I'm sure that happens with you. You get a voice in your head going, no, go left, go right, go this. But as a general rule, when we're telling a story, we don't learn anything, whereas when we listen, we do. Third saying, John 8:58, truly, truly, I say unto you, before Abraham was, I am. This is the one that's not usually included in the great I am sayings of Jesus, but it is one because he says, before Abraham was, ego eimi. So he's basically saying Christ existed before Abraham because Christ is the whole of creation. Christ is the baby. Christ is God's baby. So when Jesus says before Abraham was I am, he's not saying that Jesus was there, though the souls of all humans, I believe, are a bit like the eggs of a woman. They're all there. They're already there waiting to be fertilized. The woman is born with all the eggs she's ever going to have. So I think that in the world of Absolute are all the souls that are ever going to be born. The Kabbalah teaches, incidentally, that they're not all down yet. We've got a couple of hundred years more of new souls and the resulting chaos that's going to ensue. However, Christ is eternal. It doesn't begin, it doesn't end. We latch into it. It's a mantle that's worn by different human beings and maybe even beings from other planets, who knows. Different generations have different Christ figures. We're eternal souls. When we're connected to our Christ, should we remember that? And we form a vessel at the level of the soul that holds whoever is holding that mantle right now. Now, that's something that just came straight through while I was talking to you, so it is true that you can learn something while you speak. But I just got this wonderful idea that this first vessel, which is the one between Yesod, Hod and Netzach, the vessel of the ego of our children. The soul is the reflective vessel higher up between Tiferet, Gevurah and Hesed. And as we develop our souls and become stronger, we become vessels for the Christ. And that also helps whoever the soul who may be manifesting the Christ in the world at this moment may be, because the stronger we are, the stronger the Christ consciousness is. Fourth, I am saying is John 10:9, I am the gate. If anyone enters through me, he shall be saved and shall go in and out and find pasture. So Christhood is the doorway to divinity. I am, gate. Unfortunately, New Testament Greek isn't very fond of the word is. It would be really nice if Jesus had just shoved a little is in there, but it isn't there. So we do have to speculate. But I am the gate. So the Christ is the doorway to divinity. That's how you get to God, through the Christ consciousness. That's how you can perceive God. Joseph Campbell so beautifully put, we can't conceive of God, let alone think about God, let alone speak of God, because it's so vast. But if we are touching the Christ consciousness, we understand without understanding. We just somehow get it. And we can use Jesus as an example of a man who is doing that, but he's not the Christ. He is the guide. He is the gateway. But he's not the whole entirety of Christ. Now, a lot of Christians are going to say blasphemy immediately. But if you read the text clearly and you read it in the original language, it's really hard to come to any other conclusion that Jesus is representing something even bigger than him. Number five is, I am the good shepherd, and the good shepherd lays down his life for his sheep. But he that is an hireling and not the shepherd who own the sheep are not, see the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and fleeth. So I've got the King James one with all these S in there on slide number 15. So, and the wolf catches them and scatters the sheep. So the Christ consciousness alerts us and protects us, external things and internal things. So the Christ consciousness seeks us. If you've ever looked at Holman Hunt's wonderful painting, there's Jesus, the light of the world, standing on the other side of a door, waiting, holding the light. But we have to knock at the door. We have to ask. Ask and it is given. We have to show up. So we have to lift ourselves up. But I am the good shepherd, lays down his life for his sheep. And that means that the Christ consciousness is the whole of life, and that human beings will sacrifice themselves physically, psychologically, spiritually for the good, for the greater good. Most movies that you'll see with a mystical aspect have one person who has to sacrifice their life so that everybody else will be saved. That's a physical interpretation of it. But it's always inspirational in that movie. I'm thinking about the Poseidon Adventure, and there was a lady who was a swimmer in it. The actress played a lady who was a good swimmer, who saved several people and then died in the process. And that's a good mystical story for us. But the idea of laying down your life doesn't mean necessarily that you die. It means you give your life. You give your life to the level of the soul, you give your life to the Christ consciousness so that you can serve humanity. The ego serves people, the soul serves humanity. The two can be very, very different. But it's also very important to know that the wolf, the demons, are the internal ones that we project onto the rest of the world. Number six of the Jesus sayings is one of the most best known. I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me shall live even if he dies. And that's one of the ones which is used at most Christian funerals. It's the one I heard condemning my late husband to death as I walked up the, condemning him to hell as I walked up the aisle after Henry's body, because he was an atheist. And I had asked the vicar not to say that line, but he said, that's how the Christian service goes, dear. Sorry. But I didn't have any understanding of what that means, even though Jesus follows it by saying, in my Father's house there are many mansions. If it were not so, I would not tell you. And that's many mansions, many different pathways to faith, many different religions. But it's not interpreted like that by Christianity, but it's fairly clear that that's what it is. There are many, many ways of worship, of many ways of discovering divinity. So what this actually means is, he who believes in me. Now, let's remember, this is John's gospel. And I haven't said this about the previous ones, but it's true about them too. We are reading this as Jesus. We are reading this as Christ. So in this one, it's I am. My link, God the immanent to God the transcendent, is the resurrection and the life. If I believe in myself, If I come to myself, if I come to myself, then I shall live. So if you believe in the Christ within you, if you believe in your own divinity, if you believe in your own humanity, if you human up, if you like, instead of manning up, you'll be filled with spirit and life force. And that will guide your life, prosper your life, lead your life, and help you to die with peace. If you are conscious of the Christ consciousness, it's much easier to die. Because as the ego sloughs away, as you start dying, it will start protesting. The bardos, the Buddhist bardos, talk about the 3 days after death when the soul faces its own demons, and if it doesn't recognize them as its own demons, then it will dive back into incarnation again to escape what it sees as the external demons. Whereas if you're focused on the Christ consciousness, you know that the demons that you see approaching death are you, and they're something to be transcended. I'm not trying to scare you by saying there are always going to be demons you face when you die, but if there are, and you do see them, understand that they're just aspects of you that you need to go through and past. And the best known rule used by every fundamentalist of my acquaintance is, I am the way, the truth, the life, nobody comes to the Father but through me. Which is used to say, worship Jesus or go to hell. Gosh, what a travesty. What a cruelty. No, no, never. A man like Jesus could never say that. He could never mean that. He's a man of spirit. So how do we translate this? We go, I am the way, the truth, the life. I'm going to show it to you on the tree of life in a minute. And it just lights up on the tree of life. No one comes to the Father but through me. Emu, again. So read this as you, as Jesus. It says, I am the way, the truth, the life. Nobody comes to the Father but through their own Christ consciousness. And that's entirely true. No mystic could ever disagree with that, whether they're Sufi or a Jewish mystic or a Buddhist or whoever. You don't get to the divinity except through your own divine consciousness. And also, it's very worth mentioning, there are so many different versions of the New Testament in Greek, and there are significant amounts that do not use the word emu at the end, which is through me. Di-emu is through me or in me. There are many, many versions that say dia egu, which means as I am. So you could read it just as validly saying, I am the way through the life. No one comes to the Father but as I am. And that could certainly be Jesus talking to you, saying you don't come to the Father unless you're at the same level that I'm working at the moment, which is the Christ consciousness. You can debate this saying for ages, but trust me, it's about the Christ consciousness. It's not about who you worship. The eighth saying, this is slide number 18, is I am the true vine and my Father is the vine dresser, which means the steward or the person who trims the vine, trains the vine, and nurtures the vine. So God can nurture us only as far as our soul can receive it. Because down at the level of the ego, there's no contact with God. Although there are blessings all around us, we may not see them. We may not pick them up. But divinity will always nourish the Christ consciousness. So if we can just touch that for a nanosecond a day, we'll be nourished. And the Christ consciousness in us seeks this light because it's home. That's what's calling us home. That's what's calling us to this journey that we're all on. We're only on this webinar because we are on a journey to seek this divinity within us and to recognize our parents. Because God is both parent, mother, father, beingness, us, everything. But we do tend to project the parent aspect onto it because all good comes from this beingness. It's quite conceivable that all bad comes from this beingness too, but bad is always a conception and good is always a conception. Let's say all creation comes from this beingness. So now slide number 19, how do the sayings fit on the actual tree of life? So let's start at Keter, that is the bread, I am the bread of life. That fits at Keter at the top of the tree of life. This is slide number 19. and at the bottom. So Malkut is the physical bread, Keter is the spiritual bread, the nurturing bread. The second saying, I am the light of the world, well, that fits perfectly at Chokmah, which is the sephira of inspiration, the flash of light. This is the, on the Yetzeratic tree, on the psychological tree, this is the sephira represented by the planet Uranus, which is the planet of revelation and revolution. So light fits very well here. This is the first impulse that is actually a separation from God, although there is no separation. This is the light that streams from God to illuminate us. And the third saying is, before Abraham was I am. This is placed beautifully at Bina, which is the sephira of understanding. It's actually about understanding the way the universe works, about the cosmos. And it's talking about the great depth of understanding that the Christ consciousness was there from the very beginning. And it's also setting up the boundaries for creation, which says that the Christ consciousness was there from the beginning and it will be there at the end. It is the Alpha and the Omega. One day I'm going to do a webinar on the Book of Revelation, and that, oh boy, is that an internal journey or what? You read it as an external journey, it's ghastly, but as an internal journey, it's glorious. So the fourth saying is, I am the gatekeeper. And that is at the position of D'art, which is the window between worlds, the cat flap, as I call it, which is the opening. The gate is closed, you're in the lower world, the gate is open, you move through to the upper world. The gate is closed, you stay in the upper world, the gate is open, you move through to the lower world. If the gate is open, you can be in two worlds simultaneously. If you look at the sephira of Tiferet in the Yetzeratic world, it is the crown of the physical world, so it means you are at the peak of your power. If you're in Tiferet and there's a crisis, you can do what that legendary mother did and lift the car to get the child out underneath, even though that would be physically impossible, because at Tiferet, you are centered in yourself, you are accessing spirit, you are allowing Christ consciousness to flow down the silver cord to you, and that reflects in the lower world so you can do the impossible. So it's about physical prowess, centered in yourself and open to the Christ consciousness. And that's the gate. Open the gate, you get inspiration. Close the gate, you don't. The next one is, I am the good shepherd. This is placed at Hesed, which is the sephira of loving kindness. And the story of the Good Shepherd is that it will seek forever for the lost lamb. And that is the loving kindness of the Christ consciousness. If you extend, we mentioned this earlier, if you extend the tree of life on the lightning flash up, it makes the fifth tree right up the centre of Jacob's ladder. And on that tree, Hesed is at the Malkut of Atzilut, is at the place of the Messiah, the place of the pure Christ consciousness. So this sphere is very special in that respect. It's all about mercy, expansion, and joy. It's the planet is the planet Jupiter, which is the king of planets. And of course, the trouble with that is that that's where we get the image of Jesus as king, which the Romans just loved. They basically replaced Jupiter with Jesus, with the halo and sitting on the throne and all that. But the idea is that this is the place on the Tree of Life that represents boundless love, the shepherd who would hunt forever for just one lamb. The next saying is at Gevura, which is the I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, even though he dies, shall live. And Gevura, judgment and discrimination, which is basically about how are you reading this? How are you discerning this? How are you judging this? What level are you translating this? At what level are you reading it? Because Gevura is also translated as crisis. It can be discernment, discrimination, judgment, strength, or crisis. And Gevura is the point in our lives on the tree where we reach the crisis point where we have to repent. And to repent means think again, think anew, make a different judgment, make a new decision, resurrect, if you like, slough off the old, let go of the possessions. Because remember, when Jesus says to this young man, let go of the possessions, sell all you give, the word is possessions. And in the New Testament Greek word, the word for possession means heaviness, weight. And it's such an interesting word. Do your possessions possess you, or do you possess them? If you can't get rid of them, if you can't live without them, they possess you. They own you. And that's what the teaching is about, not allowing physical things to own you. The only thing that may own you is your soul. So I am the resurrection and the life is about understanding what all these teachings are about and being willing to embrace the concept of metanoia, which is to give up the past, give up the old thinking and embrace the new. That takes huge levels of discernment. Right, the great I am saying of I am the way, the truth, the life is not on one sphere, it's beautifully placed on three. And this is the awakening triad of the solar plexus, because Hod in both Hebrew and Greek means the way. Tiferet means truth and beauty. And Netzach means eternity or life. In New Testament Greek, Hod in Hebrew is also Hodos in Greek. And in New Testament Greek, Netzach is Zoe, which means life. So the way, the truth, the life. And this is just so beautiful for me as a Kabbalist to say that this great saying that's supposed to be so limiting, as in if you don't worship Jesus, you go to hell, is actually saying come to the awakening triad. Step away from the ego. Go to the liminal line and rise above it. Awaken. And that's exactly what Jesus says to Jairus' daughter. He says, arise, maiden, awake, maiden, arise. Come into this triangle. Come to your truth. The way, the truth, the life is the way of awakening. And the cosmic Christ is the truth and the beauty. This is the kingdom of heaven. Wake up. Come to me. Come to Christ. The next saying is, I am the true vine. And of course, the word that's relevant is there is, I am the true vine. Because there is also a false vine. There's the teachings in the Gospels, which a lot of people are confused about the fig tree, which Jesus blasts because even though it's not summertime, it hasn't got any figs for him. And people go, oh, what's all this about? What's all this about? It's a metaphor. It's simply a metaphor. When the Christ consciousness says, it is done, then it is done unless there is willful disobedience. So willful disobedience comes from the level of the ego. And I'm saying willful, but it may be will-less disobedience. Or it may even be willingness to please the tribe disobedience. You have a choice. Are you going to take that vine up to Tiferet and be answerable to Christ? Or are you going to stay down on the false vine, which would rather take care of itself and its family? Not that those are bad things to do. I'm seriously not saying you shouldn't take care of self and family. Of course you should. But this is the mystical teaching that says you have to rise to the true vine. And the true vine will always bear fruit because it will be fed and nurtured by the vinekeeper, by the steward, by God. And finally we come back down to I am the bread of life. And that's basically it for this evening. I hope you've enjoyed it, and I'm going to give you some homework, which is to find at least one of the I am sayings. Find your favourite and say it to yourself, looking into your own eyes in the mirror. And say, I am the way, the truth, the life. Nobody comes to the Father except through me. And say it, looking into your own eyes. And I just want you to do that two or three times if you can. And just see what comes to you. Because I think you'll be amazed. And remember, Jesus, the character, is an example, not a God. Christhood belongs to us. So thank you, good night, and I'll see you next week.